Now, when it comes to studying prophetic literature, most people just jump right in. And for this reason, they usually get off the track very quickly, because in order to understand these prophets, you have to understand the setting in which they minister. That's not the most fun thing we'll talk about, but it is necessary to get this background material. And over the years, I've tried to make it as simple as I know how to make it. Now, simple is a relative term. What's simple for one person is complex to another. But I've made it as simple as I know how to make it. Now, first thing we need to talk about is the major superpower of this period. The period of Isaiah, the major superpower that is just starting to rise in on the scene of history, is called the Assyrian Empire. Anybody know where they would be located on a modern map of the world? Where was their headquarters? Where was Nineveh? What modern country would it be in? If you wanted to see the ruins of Nineveh, where would you go? How about Babylon?
Well, you could join the military and go to Iraq. Because if you marched up and down the Euphrates River, you would find Babylon in the south and Nineveh in the north. The ruins of both of those cities are right there, and I'm sure some of our soldiers have visited those ruins. That's where this great empire was located. Now just stop and think how things haven't changed a whole lot in all these 2,700 years. Still, that part of the world is a major trouble source for us, is it not?
Now some of these kings, the kings that got Assyria started, was a king by the name of Tiglath-Pileser III. Believe it or not, there were two in front of him, but we're not going to talk about them. We're just going to call him Tiglath-Pileser III, or just T. He also goes by another name in the Bible. He actually has two names in the Bible. He's called Tiglath-Pileser. In other places, he's called Pul, P-U-L. Somehow I know which one of those spellings you're going to put on your papers. But he was also known as King Pul. Now, in 745, when he came to the throne, he began to expand the Assyrian Empire until it became the largest empire of mankind known up to that point in history. They conquered all of the Near East, including Palestine eventually, and even after that, eventually Egypt. Okay? Now, they used ruthlessness as the tool by which they advance their kingdom. Let me show you what their kingdom, how things kind of set up here during Isaiah's day. In Isaiah's day, the Assyrian Empire had already come right down here to the borders of Egypt. All of this in the red and going clear back off of the map. It was already under Assyrian control. During Isaiah's day, the red advances even further south to the border of Judah. So that during a large part of Isaiah's ministry, all you had left of the people of God was Judah, which was about the size of the state of Rhode Island, one of our smallest states. I've forgotten the exact dimensions, it doesn't matter. It's a postage stamp kingdom. That's where Isaiah ministered, right here, with the Sea of Red advancing south. In fact, the climax in the book of Isaiah, the Sea of Red comes right up to the walls of Jerusalem. As Isaiah will depict it, Jerusalem is like in a flood up to the neck. That's pretty serious business. And the flood is red, and the red is Assyria. Now the Assyrians were not very diplomatic in the way they went about doing business. Their main tactic was to instill fear on the part of people. We actually have pictures of the Assyrians at work. Can anybody tell me what this Assyrian gentleman is doing here to this naked captain? You guys can see it. All right. What's he doing? Your mind probably won't let you even think what he's doing. He you notice that the artist has depicted the guy's ribs. You notice the guy staked out on the ground, hands and feet. You notice the Assyrian soldier has a knife in his hand here. What is he doing? He's skinning him. The Assyrians would lay out their victims and skin them alive or behead them and pile their heads up outside the city to warn other people that they shouldn't rebel against the Assyrians. Well, in fact, here you see another Assyrian soldier walking off with a head in his hand. See that? Now, these pictures come right off Assyrian monuments. These are not pictures drawn by the enemies of Assyria. These are pictures drawn by the Assyrians bragging about what they've done. Pretty true. And they intimidated everybody. I got a couple more like that just to watch the girls squeam a little bit here. And I do. Okay. Here's another one. This is the same one we saw in color there. But take a look at this one. What's going on in that picture? Here's a captive being held by an Assyrian. What's this guy got? What does it look like to you that he has in his hand? What? A pair of tongs. He's holding this guy's head, the captive's head, in tongs. And this guy has his hands on what? His beard. What's he doing? Pulling out his beard. Not only painful, but in the Near East, humiliating for a man to be seen without a beard. Remember a couple of years ago when we caught Saddam Hussein, he had lice all over him, and they shaved his beard and they shaved his head, and it was an international outrage. Because to an Arab man, you don't shave the beard. That's the ultimate humiliation. And that's what they're doing, inflicting not only pain, but humiliation. Here they're doing the same thing. He's got his hands on his beard here, ripping out the beard. So that was another thing the Assyrians did. Now take a look at this one down here, because of the passage that this will have bearing on. Here is an Assyrian holding a spear. The picture doesn't come out very well. It's kind of faded on the monument. He's got a spear to what part of the body of that captive? To his eyes. Any of you know a prominent person in the Bible who had his eyes punctured out by, wasn't an Assyrian, but it was a Babylonian, they did the same thing. Had his eyes punctured like that? No, well, yeah, that's later. That's earlier. But King Zedekiah, the last king of the Old Testament, had his eyes punctured out after he watched his own children killed in front of him. The last sight he saw was his own children being killed. So this guy's having his eyes put out, and then if you notice carefully, I know the picture's not the greatest, it's not my fault, it's the way the picture is on the monument, but they have something going up here to the mouth and or nose of that captive. What is going on there? Well, that's the fish hook that the Bible talks about. Captives were strung up on liners, like you string up fish, you fishermen types, and they'd run a fish hook up through their nose, or a hook up, so I suppose it was a real fish hook, but it was a hook that went up through their nose and hooked them onto this line. They'd just have a whole line of captives hauled off in captivity. You can imagine how that would hurt if they got a little slow in walking, or got a little off the track, or staggered a little bit along the way. It would yank and pull and jerk in the mouth and nasal areas. Now those are the Assyrians. So Tiglath-Pileser was the king that got this empire started. He was followed by another king mentioned in the Bible, Shalmaneser. Didn't actually last very long. As you can see, his reign is very short. He's important because he is the one who attacked Samaria. Somebody here tell me what or who or what Samaria was. Does anybody know? Yes, sir. It was the capital of the northern kingdom called Israel. That is correct. Okay. And Shalmaneser attacked Samaria. Some question about whether he captured the place or not. The next guy takes credit for capturing Samaria. His name is Sargon. He actually hauled the captives from Samaria off into captivity. And then, of course, Sennacherib's the one we're going to be talking mostly about in this class, because he's the one that brought the Assyrian Red Tide right down to the walls of Jerusalem. He's an arrogant fellow, and we'll be saying a lot about him as our course goes on. Now, I've tried to get kids over the years to remember these four Assyrian kings with a little rap. You know, you need a little rap. Okay, it's like Tiglath-Pileser, Shalmaneser, Sargon, and Sennacherib. Tiglath-Pileser, Shalmaneser, Sargon, and Sennacherib. Try it again. Tiglath-Pileser, Shalmaneser, Sargon, and Sennacherib. One more time. Tiglath-Pileser, Shalmaneser, Sargon, and Sennacherib. You've learned the four major Assyrian kings who had to do with Bible history. Do you realize that puts you in an elite class? I'll bet you there aren't 1% of the students in college across America today that can name the four Assyrian kings that are mentioned in the Bible. But you can. Tiglath-Pileser, Shalmaneser, Sargon, and Sennacherib. Now, in Judah, Isaiah is a prophet in Judah, the southern kingdom. If you turn in your Bible to the first verse of the book of Isaiah, you will find these kings mentioned. Look at the first verse. He tells you when he lived. Somebody read the first verse.
Division concerning Judah and Jerusalem that Isaiah, son of Amon, saw during the reigns of Isaiah, Ahaz, and
Hezekiah. Okay, there they are. The four that I list right there in your syllabus. Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, Hezekiah. I've tried to give you some little caption to remember what's going on in the reign of those four kings. This is not a course in Bible history, so we're not going to obviously go into details on this. King Uzziah, prosperity. Kingdom of Judah reached the greatest height that it had had since the days of Solomon. Wealth was flowing into the city of Jerusalem. The borders were expanding. Everything was going fine until Uzziah did something very stupid. Does anybody know what stupid thing he did that got him hung big time in a hurry? He tried to walk in the temple and take over the priesthood. And under God's law, only the sons of Aaron could serve as priests. And so to teach him a lesson, and all subsequent kings of Judah, God smote him with leprosy, and this fellow Uzziah had to spend his last days out by himself in a leper house. And the reign was turned over to his son Jotham, who didn't reign very long independently, because he actually was sharing the throne pretty much in a kind of a shared situation with his father, who was incapacitated during a good part of his reign. So we might call Jotham's reign, which didn't last very long, just transitional. Nothing major importance happened during that period. And then Ahaz. Now Isaiah is going to have a lot to do with Ahaz in the book, and I've labeled his days evil days. Ahaz was a non-believer, a skeptic. We're going to find that he was offered a wonderful opportunity by Isaiah to name a miracle that he wanted God to do. He refused. He didn't have anything to do with miracles and such. He wasn't interested in dealing with his problems from a spiritual perspective and through the perspective of faith in God. And so, during Ahaz's day, we list three things we need to be aware of: the political conditions. The political conditions in Ahaz's day were that Ahaz was under attack. A coalition of neighboring states attacked Judah with the intention of getting rid of Ahaz. His own people didn't like him. The neighboring states didn't like him, and they invaded with an intention of getting rid of him. Now, The problem with that is that Ahaz was the rightful king. He was a descendant of David. He had the right to sit on the throne. And Isaiah was sent to him with words of reassurance and words of hope in that crisis, which we will study in more detail down the road. So you don't need to try to learn it all in one day. Religious conditions under Ahaz. Well, since Ahab himself was a skeptic and a non-believer, a lot of paganism crept into Judah. Some of the pagan altars were actually put into the temple precincts. And it was a pathetic situation throughout this little country of Judah. They were really off the track with God during his reign. Economic conditions, the rich were getting richer and the poor were getting poorer. There was no middle class. The middle class had been wiped out. You were either enormously rich or tremendously poor. And the rich, of course, were always beating up on the poor, taking away their property rights and their homes and putting them into slavery and such. Now those are the four kings that Isaiah mentions in the first verse of his book. And they were the kings who were active during the major part of Isaiah's ministry. However, his life lapsed over into the reign of the next king, who was Manasseh. Not mentioned in verse 1 of the book because I think Isaiah's ministry was largely over. He was in retirement. Now, according to very early Jewish legend, Isaiah was killed by this King Manasseh. King Manasseh was the worst king that ever lived. Ahaz was bad. Manasseh was the worst. And he's a pathetic guy in the Bible because at the very end of his reign, he also reigned the longest in the king, 55 years. And at the very end of his reign, Manasseh was hauled off to Babylon by the king, the Syrian king, and he there repented. And God restored him back to Jerusalem. And he spent his last few months on the throne trying to undo what he had spent 55 years doing. I think he's the most pathetic creature in the Bible. Just think about that. To spend your last months of life trying to undo all the evil that you yourself are responsible for. Got to be a heartbreaking, heart-wrenching situation. Now he killed, according to the early tradition, this is not in the Bible, there's a hint of it in the Bible. Only a hint. According to early Jewish tradition, Manasseh killed Isaiah by sawing him asunder. You know the old magician's trick where you put them in the thing and you saw the thing in two? Only this wasn't a trick. This was the real thing. And the book of Hebrews, chapter 11, does mention the fact that some were sawn asunder. Probably a reference to Isaiah, although his name is not directly used. So those are the kings of Judah. We've now learned the kings of Assyria, and we've learned the five kings of Judah that should concern us, particularly two of them, Ahaz and Hezekiah. Hezekiah, I didn't mention Hezekiah, he's a great king. Launched a reform movement. The greatest king in the Bible from the standpoint of his faith. You will love him. He had a problem that some of us have, even though we're people of faith. We do have a little bit of pride, and he had a good bit of pride that God had to humble. There's an illustration of how when a person has faith in the Lord will work through circumstances to shape them up and make them even better. Now, I want you to see something as I have tried to boil down the book of Isaiah in the simplest possible terms. If you can learn these four things, some of you are already discouraged, you're ready to head out, hit that button on the computer and get rid of this place.
I understand.
A, B, C, and D. Here's the whole message of the book of Isaiah, the four statements. That's what we're going to be talking about for a whole semester. A. The Assyrians are coming, but they will not prevail. That's the first thing Isaiah has to get across. The Assyrians are coming, but they will not prevail. B. Babylon is coming after the Assyrians, and they will temporarily prevail. C. Cyrus the Persian is coming, and he will prevail over Babylon. Point three. And then the fourth point, maybe the most important of all, David's son is coming, and he will finally prevail forever. Now that's the whole message of the book of Isaiah in a nutshell, people. Now it took me 40 years to figure that out. Just a simple little breakdown. Sometimes simplicity is the hardest thing because we miss the forest for the trees. Those are the four major emphases in the book of Isaiah. Now, if we can go back to your notes, as we try to get this historical background in a manageable condition, okay? There were five crises. I like to think of Isaiah's ministry revolving around five historical crises, all of which, of course, are recorded in the books of Kings and Chronicles in your Bible. Crisis number one, what is called the Syro-Ephraimitic invasion of Judah. Now let's break that down. Syro-Ephraimitic. Don't let the name throw you. It's just a big name the scholars have come up with. Syro stands for Syria. Ephraimitic stands for Ephraim, another name for the northern kingdom. So what are we saying here? Syria and Ephraim have come together in a coalition to attack Judah. Remember I told you under Ahaz they were trying to come in and do what? What were they trying to do? I tell you again here in your notes. They were trying to remove King Ahaz from the throne. Now, I didn't tell you why. The reason why they were trying to remove King Ahaz from the throne was because King Ahaz was playing footsie with the Assyrians. Everybody knew the Assyrians were the next major power to arise. They could see it coming. And they were scared to death. So all the little countries were banding together. Here's Ahaz down in Judah, right in the middle. You look at a map. He's right in the middle of all these other countries that were going to take us. We're going to stand against the Syrians. Right in the middle of them was a little country called Judah. And Ahaz said, you're crazy. You're crazy. We aren't going to stand up to that Syria. We are going to join in with them. And the rest of them said, oh, no, you're not. And this launched this Syro-Ephraimitic invasion where they were out to remove Ahaz from the throne and put their own man on the throne who would be more sympathetic to a stand against Babylon. Now, what was the role of Isaiah in this particular crisis? Now, let me assure you before I mention that, I see some of you are thinking, man, sign up for Isaiah, what's all this history saying? You'll never understand Isaiah. Don't get this history down pat. Be not discouraged, little flock. All of these crises will come back to us in the text. You'll be working through them in your workbooks. We'll be talking about them in class. I'm trying to give you an overview so you see where we're going. Everybody understand what we're doing here? I don't expect you to master all of this information with this opening lecture. So what was the role of Isaiah in the Syro-Ephraimitic invasion? Let me review. What does Syro stand for? Ephraimitic. So what were they invading Judah for? Come on. Speak up. Remove King Ahaz. What was the role of Isaiah? He promised deliverance for Judah. And he offered a miraculous sign that God would protect the Davidic dynasty, the sons of David. Meaning Ahaz, who was the current representative of that dynasty. Now that was not because Ahaz was a godly king. Far from it. But Isaiah knew that it was God's purpose. God had made a promise to David years before that his descendants would occupy the throne in Jerusalem. And because of that promise, God says, I'll see you through this crisis, even though you, Ahaz, are a rotten egg. Now, there's no verse of Scripture that calls Ahaz a rotten egg. He might as well have. He was an unbeliever. What was the outcome? Ahaz said, I don't want any part of miracles. I'm not seeking a religious solution. Keep your religion to yourself. I want to solve my problems by political means. I will go to Tiglath-Pileser, Tiggy as he knew him, and I will make an agreement with Tiggy to come down here and just crush these people who are attacking me, and I will pledge my allegiance to Tiglath-Pileser, the fireman. That was the stand of Ahaz. And so you really have a confrontation during this first crisis between a man of faith, and that, by the way, is what Isaiah was trying to get them to do the whole time. Put your faith in God. There is no crisis so great but what faith will not see you through. And Ahaz said, I want part of that. I'm not a faith man. I'm a political strategist. Common sense tells me I should line up with this powerful new king and not fool around with something's going to get me crushed. Well, he wound up getting crushed anyway, because he didn't follow the path of faith. Second crisis. This one does not so much directly affect Isaiah, but indirectly it does. It was when the Assyrians came and attacked the northern kingdom of Israel. Now remember, we're in a period where you have two kingdoms, Israel in the north, Judah in the south. They're all descended from Abraham. We can't get into all that history. But somewhere around 723, the Assyrians came against the northern kingdom. The invader was Shalmaneser, as in, let's hear it. You have about as much enthusiasm as a wounded caterpillar. Can we manufacture a little bit of enthusiasm in this
class?
Okay, well, some of us are fading a little bit on Shalmaneser, but we'll work on it. We'll work. We're doing rap tryouts today, so some of you may make my rap team. Okay. Now, we've got Shalmaneser, and notice that when Sargon first got into the picture, he was the general of Shalmaneser. That's why there's some question. Was it Shalmaneser that actually captured Samaria? Was it Sargon? Sargon claimed it. He did it. And he may have done it as general. There's some question. It doesn't affect us for this class. I mean, it's just an interesting historical issue. What was the role of Isaiah in this crisis? Well, he's not directly involved because he lived down south. However, he's involved to this extent. He predicted it would happen. So we're going to run into predictions where Isaiah predicted what this was going to happen. Samaria's going to fall. Northern kingdom's going to fall. They're all going to be carried off into captivity. And furthermore, he predicted that someday God would bring them back from that captivity. So to that extent, he is involved in this crisis. What was the outcome? Well, Samaria was captured, and thousands, tens of thousands of the northern kingdom citizens were hauled off and dispersed all over the Assyrian Empire. Any of you ever heard references to the 10 lost tribes? Well, I'm sure if you got on the internet and looked up 10 lost tribes, you'd find a lot of kooks with a lot of ideas. Because there's a whole theological system that thinks that the 10 lost tribes migrated into Europe, that the United States and Great Britain are the Ephraim and Manasseh of the Bible, that we are the people of God as Americans, all of which is baloney, however you slice it. What happened to the 10 lost tribes? Did they migrate into Europe? No evidence. What happened to them? They dispersed and they intermarried with local people, and over time most of them just kind of disappeared, and a few didn't. Joined later with the Jews and came back to Palestine. And some of them are mentioned in the Bible. So, does anybody know what this theology that says that the United States, the British Commonwealth, are the lost tribes of Ephraim and that, you know what that's called? There's no reason you should know, I'm just curious. It's called Anglo-Israelism. Now, another version of that is found in the Book of Mormon, in which the American Indians are the lost tribes of the Bible. And, of course, the story of the Book of Mormon is supposedly how Christ came and appeared to preach the gospel to the Indians here in America and all that kind of thing as well. That's a different brand of baloney, but still baloney. Now, third crisis. This one did affect Isaiah very much. It was the sickness of King Hezekiah. At a certain point, Hezekiah became sick unto death. We're going to study that in detail. I keep reminding you, some of you are discouraged already. You're ready to throw in the pencil, turn in your red pen. Now, what did I tell you a moment ago about Hezekiah? Good or bad?
Good.
He's not only good, he's the best. The best. Well, the Bible says he was the best king that ever reigned up to his point in time. And from the standpoint of his faith, he had tremendous faith in him. He comes down with, the Bible calls it a boil. Now, I've had boils in the back of my neck. They're very painful. Aren't they? But they're not like that. So what the Bible calls a boil, I think, is probably what we would today call cancer. And Isaiah came to him and said, you're going to die and not live. In fact, it's a memorable verse. He says to the king, set your house in order, for you will die and not live. Not very often in the Bible where a righteous man is told in advance, you're going to die. A lot of times wicked people are told, you're going to die shortly. But one of the few times in the Bible where a righteous man is told, you're going to die. Get organized. Get your things, your affairs under control. You're going to die of this disease. And Hezekiah turned his face to the wall and he wept and prayed. Now, he'd been a wonderful king up to that point in time. The Bible says that God saw his tears. It doesn't say God took account of all the good things that Hezekiah had done. It says God saw his tears. God said, Isaiah, turn around and go back. He'd already left, gone on his way. God said, Isaiah, turn around and go back. Tell that man that I'm going to extend his life by 15 years. I'm going to give him 15 more years. Now, a lot of interesting questions about this fight. Number one, why was a godless man of faith like Hezekiah so upset with the news he's going to die? Answer, I don't think it was because he feared death. Although there is a natural fear of the unknown in all of us, and that's not inappropriate. But I think it was because he knew he had led his country into coming back to God and knew the Assyrians were going to punish him for it. Just a matter of time. And so he felt responsible. I've gotten my little tiny country in this, taking them down this path. I know they're going to face this crisis. Lord, I don't want them to have to go through it on their own. I got them into it. I want to be around to see them out of it. So God extended his life by 15 years. Crisis number four. After Hezekiah recovered from his sickness, that God, as God told him he would, he received some dignitaries, some outstanding representatives from far off Babylon. Now, Babylon at this point was a major power, but not on the same level as Assyria. They were actually in the Assyrian Empire. But there was a king in Babylon who hated the Assyrians and was looking for somebody to join with him in trying to throw off the Assyrian yoke. Now he sent his ambassadors to Hezekiah. On the surface, they pretended to be coming to congratulate him on his recovery. We're bringing you news from our king. We wanted us here to congratulate you on your recovery. In reality, they were there to spy out the land. They wanted to know, is Hezekiah worthy of becoming an ally in the battle against Assyria? Is he dependable? Can we rely upon him? And these ambassadors came under false pretense. Now what does Hezekiah do? What he should have done was say, thank you fellows, I appreciate your remarks. Goodbye. Let me help you. I'll see you out. Here's the way you go home. But what he did is pride. Remember I told you I had a little problem with pride? There are a lot of people that are people of faith that have a little, I expect some of you have a little problem with pride. Hezekiah began to show these men all of his treasures, just a boast, all of his wealth, all of his weaponry. He showed them everything he had. And Isaiah came back and he said, what? He asked him a very pointed question. Boy, what an embarrassing question this would be for some of us. What have they seen in your house? What have these heathen, pagan guys from Babylon seen in your house, King Hezekiah, man of God, man of faith? Hezekiah said, I showed them everything. Now, Smith's paraphrase of the response of Isaiah was, how stupid can you be? Now, you won't find any English version that puts it quite that way, but that's in effect what he said. He said, Hezekiah, don't you realize that it's Babylon that's actually going to destroy Jerusalem? It's Babylon that's going to come and carry off some of your relatives into exile over yonder in far off Babylon. You have actually opened the door, you've triggered their interest, you've whetted their appetite, and in a few years they're going to come back. Not Assyria. You're worried about Assyria? Forget Assyria. God's going to deal with Assyria, but Babylon is going to come. So, that was crisis number 4. Crisis number 5, and this is the biggest of all. When the Assyrians actually did invade Judah in 701, that I don't ask you to remember very many dates. But that is the date I want you to remember. 701 B.C. This is King Sennacherib, the Assyrian. He comes against Hezekiah, and his purpose is to punish Hezekiah for going down the road of religious reform. God's purpose is to show everyone throughout the ages his power over this great Assyrian army. Now, get the picture. Assyrian army. How many people in the army? Well, we know there were around 200,000 men in Sennacherib's army. By the way, we not only have the biblical account of this incident, we have Sennacherib's version. We have his own record. One of those rare occurrences where we have a story in the Bible and the same story from the standpoint of the other. And Sennacherib tells us he came into Judah and he conquered 40, I believe it's 48, maybe it's 46, I forgot. 48 or 46, whatever it is, outlying cities. And he pinned Hezekiah up in Jerusalem like a bird in a cage. It's a famous quote from that document of Sennacherib. And he sent men up there to Jerusalem to demand that Hezekiah surrender. And in the process of making that demand, Sennacherib blasphemed the God of the Bible. He made it appear that the God of the Bible was no different than any other god. His argument was basically, no other deity has been able to stand before my armies. What makes you think your God can stand before my heart? Don't trust Hezekiah. Don't trust his faith plan. Surrender now or all of you will die. And we'll stack your heads outside Jerusalem. Well, Isaiah sent word to the king, don't worry, God will deliver you. King Sennacherib writes out a letter, sends it to Hezekiah. Hezekiah took this scroll, letter written on a scroll, into the temple. And the Bible says he spread it out before the Lord. He got down on his knees and prayed. And Isaiah sent a second message. He says, they will not even shoot one arrow against this city. I mean, that was impossible. That's what God said. And that night the angel of the Lord went through the camp of the Assyrian soldiers. 180,000 of them died. One. That's not a pleasure. I love the way the King James Version puts it. It says they woke up in the morning and lo, they were dead. Now you can have all your fancy translations in the world, but you can't beat that. Kind of like some churches I know of, I wish we'd wake up some Sunday morning and say, lo, we are dead. So God rescued Jerusalem and destroyed the Assyrian army just like he said. Now, I tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to tell you exactly what's going to be on your quiz Thursday. I'm going to ask you to list the five crises. List the five crises through which Isaiah's ministry went. You don't have to know all the details, just list the five crises. Anybody think you can't do that? You will be able to do that by Thursday, and everybody will get off to a good start. In fact, just by showing up today, you got off to a good start, because I will give you all 100 on your first quiz just for being here. Now, I'm supposed to let you out because we've got some major activity here facing us here in a few moments, so I'm going to let you go at this point. Aliens will join them and unite with the house of Jacob. Now let's talk about this, because with the tyrant gone, Israel will have rest in its own land. With the Assyrian tyrant removed, remember Babylon is part of the Assyrian Empire in this period, the people of Israel will have rest in their own land at least for a while. But I don't think they had complete rest until the one king who said, come unto me all you that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Meaning, of course, fall. Now he says, notice this, some of you are working with the Gentiles or missions, evangelism type things. Look at this verse. I hope this hasn't escaped you. Aliens or foreigners will join them and unite with the house of Jacob. That's a passage that needs to be in your term paper if that's your topic. Because you have a picture here of Gentiles uniting with the people of Israel to be part of this kingdom of the future. And so he's looking down into the Messianic age for this rest that they're going to experience and for this unity with the Gentiles. Nations will take them and bring them to their own place. Along the way, Gentiles like King Cyrus helped God's people go back to their homeland. Gentiles like Constantine made the Christian religion a legal religion. And that was both good and bad. But he tried to help the Christians by making Christianity legal. In 325, for the first time in history, Christianity became a legal religion. That's an example of non-believers assisting and helping God's people. That's what we have here. And the house of Israel will possess the nations as men servants and maid servants. Now remember, the New Testament, the church of the Lord Jesus Christ, is the new Israel of God. Don't buy into this garbage that says, well, God has two peoples on earth. He has a physical people and a spiritual people. No, that's not so. All the privileges and rights that belong to the Israelite people, Jesus said, Matthew 21, I think it's verse 43 or thereabouts, that would be transferred to another nation. And Peter in 1 Peter chapter 2 verse 9 identifies that other nation. And it turns out to be Christian. We are a nation. We are a race. Next time on the census they ask you what race you are, say Christian.
Peter says you're a race.
I don't recognize any race except that I'm a Christian. It's the only race that matters anyway. But why do we play this game that the politicians love to play, where they pit one group against the other? The next time somebody asks you what you are, say, I'm a Christian.
Well, be good.
I'm a Christian. Well, if they want to come out and check me out, put down what they think, that's fine. I can't stop them from doing that, but ask me what I think. I'm a Christian. I'm not Caucasian or anything else. I'm a Christian. Now, well, that makes sense. Well, okay, we're part of this tonight. 1 Peter 2:9 is my proof text. All right, and 1 Peter 2:9 takes all of the terminology that was used in the Old Testament in reference to Israel and applies it to the church. The church is God's Israel. So passages like this that talks about the house of Israel, which house of Israel? The literal, physical descendants of Abraham. The context here is in the day when the Gentiles join Israel. And notice, they will possess the nations as men servants. The Gentiles, the nations. This is, you people in the conversion papers, this needs to be there. In what sense, somebody who read the commentary for today, in what sense do the Gentiles become servants, slaves of Mount Zion? Of the New Testament Israel. What sense? Yes. What I'm trying to get across in the commentary is that all of us who, from the world point of view, were Gentiles, all of us I presume were, we became Christians. We became servants, did we not, of Jesus Christ? In fact, the Greek word is slave. Now, most of us in this room would do anything to advance the cause of Christ. We sacrifice financially. We sacrifice time. We let Christ, through His Word, govern our conduct. We are all slaves of Jesus Christ. Slaves of His kingdom. That's what we're talking about here in Old Testament prophetic language. The house of Israel will possess the nations. Why? Because they come to Mount Zion. They become part of Mount Zion. You and I are part of Mount Zion, and yet we have dedicated our lives to serving the people of God. They will make captives of their captors and rule over their oppressors. Talking about Israel here, the true Israel, the spiritual Israel, the church. Make captives of their captors and rule over their oppressors. History is full of examples of where those who set out to be harmful to the church of the Lord Jesus Christ were converted and became Christians themselves. That's what we're talking about. Any of you ever heard of General Lee Wallace? None of you are Civil War buffs like I am. General Lee Wallace is a general in the Civil War. He authored a book called Ben-Hur. Have you heard of Ben-Hur? Seen the movie? Maybe. Lee Wallace is Navy. And after the Civil War, he decided to dedicate himself to writing a book that would show Christianity to be totally fraudulent. In the process of researching that book, he himself was converted and wound up writing the book Ben-Hur as his testimony to the truth of the Christian faith. Now, the story of Lew Wallace can be multiplied many times over of people who set out to destroy Christianity intellectually and sometimes even physically, who were themselves converted. And he became great. Well, look at the Apostle Paul. Prime example. Set out to destroy Christianity and wound up to be its greatest champion. But that's happened over and over again. That's what we're talking about here in prophetic language. how the captives, that is, those who are subject to persecution, will take possession of their captors and rule over their oppressors. It's happened many times. On the day that the Lord gives you relief from the suffering and turmoil and cruel bondage, that's when the Assyrian Empire was brought down, you will take up this taunt song against the King of Babylon. The title of the King of Assyria was King of Babylon, because Babylon was such an important concept culturally. The kings of Assyria took that title, King of Babylon. I think we're primarily here talking about the King of Assyria, who takes this title, King of Babylon. And people begin to make light of him in the light of the fact that that God has broken him. How the oppressor has an end. How his fury has ended. The Lord has broken the rod of the wicked and the scepter of rulers. Talking about the Assyrians, which in anger struck down peoples with unceasing blows, and in fury subdued nations with relentless aggression.
The Assyrians.
All the lands are at rest and at peace. They break into singing. The world has peace once the Assyrian tyrant has been brought down. God will bring them down. Even the pine trees and the cedars of Lebanon exult. The trees rejoice because these tyrants would cut down the trees for the use in their military equipment and for the use in their building projects. And with the tyrant gone, the trees will have relief. So he pictures poetically, of course, the trees rejoicing. Now, those of you who are literalists, I suppose you need to bring a harmonica out to the woods with you and see if you can get the trees to join in. But the rest of us who understand poetry and understand that this is a figure of speech. The grave, that is Sheol. Now the NIV says grave, bad translation. The Hebrew says Sheol. Sheol is the abode of the dead. Sheol is not the grave. No matter how hard the Jehovah's Witnesses say it, it isn't true. The NIV has blown the translation. Sheol is the abode of the dead, the waiting place where the spirits of the departed wait until the resurrection and judgment. Can't get into that any more than just that a little bit. In the New Testament, what's the name for Sheol? Hades. Hades is the name for Sheol in the New Testament. Now, so he pictures Sheol all astir as the king of Babylon, the Assyrian king. They rise up, the departed, to greet you. All of those who were leaders in the world. It makes them rise from their thrones. All of those who were kings over the nations, they will all respond and say to you, you have also become weak as we are. So he's mocked. The king of Assyria is mocked as he comes down to the grave. Now, move on down here to verse 12, and that's about all the time we're going to have today, and try to get verse 12 in for sure. In the King James Version, in verse 12, it says, how have you fallen from heaven, O Lucifer? That's the only translation I know of that does that. Modern translation. And Lucifer, in popular literature, is a name for the devil. Lucifer in the Bible is not a name for the devil. So you want to call the devil Lucifer, you're not using biblical language. I mean, he's got plenty of other names, Satan, devil, prince of the power of the air, and on, but Lucifer is not one of his names. In fact, none of the newer translations even have Lucifer, except the old King James, and it's a bad translation at this point. Who is this one who has fallen from heaven? The political heaven, where the sun, the moon, the stars, goes from where the rulers are. It's the political sky. He's fallen from the political sky, from the position of being a ruler, don't you see? It's the king of Babylon, that is Assyria. I will raise my throne above the stars of God. I will sit enthroned in the mount of the assembly at the utmost height. This is the arrogance of the king of Assyria in his own mind. He was going to be more powerful than God himself. By the way, you people that are working on the names of God, here's one of them right here, the Most High. I hope that's on your list. Okay? Should be. He anticipates being greater, more powerful than God himself. The arrogance of this particular king. Now the people in Sheol who see you stare at you, they ponder your face. Is this the man who shook the earth and made the kingdoms tremble? The man who made the world a desert and overthrew its cities? The same way I felt when I looked into the eyeballs of that shrunken mummy of Pharaoh in the Egyptian Museum. I looked him right in the eye, the Pharaoh who once ruled the world. The Pharaoh who told Moses, "Who is Yahweh that I should obey his voice?" I looked into his little beady eyes. He didn't scare me any. He shriveled up. He doesn't. This guy rules the world. And that's the same way they thought about the king of Babylon here. Anyway, and he goes on to talk about how the king would not be buried, his corpse would be thrown out, and he would be eaten by the worms and the maggots and all that good stuff. So much for the king. But the main thing I want to get across to you on this is that this Lucifer thing is not the devil. This is the king of Babylon, and in his own arrogance and pride, he thought that he would become a great and powerful, more powerful than God. God says, "I will sweep her with the broom of destruction, the Babylon, cut off Babylon, her name, survivors, offspring, descendants," on and on, the end of Babylon. Then he goes immediately to describe how Assyria would be broken in the land. We're going to read about that. 185 Assyrian soldiers died in one night. And that's what he's been talking about in poetry in the preceding verses in this chapter. All right, I want to pass out your internet off.